Good evening, Larry. Happy Saturday night.
Hi, Andy. How's it going?
It is pretty nice. It was a gloomy day, but I did get a message today that we got a new patron.
Wow. That sounds fantastic. Yippee.
Yep. We have a new patron named Christy. Thank you so much. We're joining the Art Registry Matters team at the Hustler level. Blue balls for you, Christy. Those will go out in the mail. I'll send it out sometime next week. And you too can be a recipient of your own blue balls by becoming a patron over at patreon.com/registrymatters. Join the many others who support the podcast and force Larry into making statements about humility.
What does that mean?
Humility. That's where you appreciate other people's gestures that support you.
Well, I just did appreciate that gesture that supported us.
Absolutely. We have a guest joining us, don't we?
We do indeed.
Let that one go.
So welcome to our guest this evening. That would be Ken Ackerman in the state of Nebraska, the Cornhusker state, where the Nebraska Cornhusker football team has filled the stadium for record sellouts since 1961 or three or somewhere many decades ago. Are they still holding that trend of selling out the stadium, even though they haven't been as successful lately, Ken?
365 times in a row.
Hang on, I got a question. How is it that they bus all 100,000 people that live in the state into one stadium?
Oh, I started from Omaha a couple of weeks ago, and the traffic slowed to a crawl about 35 miles away from Lincoln and was stop and go for the last 10 miles. And I left at 8 o'clock for a 11 o'clock game and got there at 10:30. But well, it takes a long time to find parking and to get all it sorted out.
What's phenomenal about that is the Nebraska and my state, New Mexico, are similar in population. And we don't have the rich tradition of football that they have there, but we draw 18,000. And what is the capacity? It's something like 90,000 in that stadium.
90,000, yep. And today's game was 86,400.
And Nebraska won
today.
And they've been filling that thing since the early 1960s. With every time they have a game there.
That's right.
It's really phenomenal.
That's right, every time.
And Ken is with Nebraskans Unafraid, and he's very active in advocacy in Nebraska, and he's going to talk to us. We've talked on the podcast several times about an important case that has to do with the issue is whether juveniles with non-Nebraska convictions have to register. And we spent a lot of time on the case because it really illustrates some important points regarding which court has control, and it also illustrates judicial philosophy. And a lot of our people, as I always say, are very conservative in nature, and they're textualist, or so they think. And this was an example of how the decision between a court that views itself as a textualist court, which would be the Nebraska Supreme Court, which is the final interpreter of Nebraska law, and the federal court, the United States District Court, and the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals, how, as they looked at more of the intent of the law. That's why we bring this up again. So Ken is here to tell us the last time we talked about this, we were talking about we discussed that the federal court had enjoined Nebraska from releasing juveniles to the public, even though the Nebraska Supreme Court had said they are registrable in the state of Nebraska, in the case of Nebraska versus Clemens. And we've written about that in the Narsal newsletter, in the issue that just went out in October, those that want to read the article. But subsequently, the attorney representing Mr. Weir was the attorney representing adjudicated juveniles, asked the federal court to enjoin Nebraska from actually releasing those names. And I opined that it wouldn't be long to Judge Koff, who was the federal judge who had issued the injunction, would have to fold his tent. So Ken, pick it up from there. There was a hearing this past week in the United States District Court for the District of Nebraska with Judge Richard Koff, and you sat through that. So tell us how that went down, and focus on how I'm really interested in how it I would guess that Judge Koff was somewhat troubled by having to do what he had to do. So walk us through what you observed.
Well, it was really interesting because the court hearing took over an hour and a half. And Judge Koff opened up, they accepted some stipulants that they both agreed on. And then there was another stipulant that the state side, represented by Chris Postman, objected to. And the judge overrode almost all of the objections that the state had. So it looked good to start with. But then Judge Koff turned to Josh Weir and started posing questions, and every single question had the point of view of, well, if I'm going to rule this, why should I do this? Why should I rule that? Why should I accept that? Your client was on the registry in Iowa and he's on the registry in Nebraska. What has changed? And everything seemed to be completely to the contrary. And Josh Weir struggled with answers and everything. And then he turned to the state side and asked similar hard-to-answer questions. So I've realized that the way that Judge Koff works is that he takes the opposing side to each person and asks the challenging questions in order to see if he can come up with a reason to continue the stay. And it was the first thing he asked was, are you guys ready to go to trial? And each one said no, they just wanted to continue the stay. And eventually he ruled that he could not continue the stay. So the state patrol now is going to have to put 65 registrants back on the registry that were adjudicated as juveniles in other states.
And what's troubling about this is clearly, if you take the point of view that I take as a progressive, that the law should be interpreted to take into account harmonization and the intent. Since Nebraska does not define registrants to include those who are adjudicated as juveniles, clearly you would think that the intent would be that they not register out-of-state adjudications, but they have that in the definition of a sex offender, which they adopted in 2009, became operational in 2010. They put language in there, anyone who enters Nebraska who is required to register in another state. And
let me be specific. It's in any town, city, state, or federal jurisdiction. You're registered in any of those places, you're required to register in Nebraska. And what was even more fascinating was the state's position. They said, well, you know, there probably are some juveniles who may have done their crimes on the Indian reservation, and that's other jurisdictions. So they would also, juveniles who are adjudicated there, would have to register in Nebraska, even though they're Nebraska residents.
So that potentially opens up an additional group. It'd be a relatively small number because there's not a lot of Indian Indian reservation land that encompasses large numbers of people in Nebraska, as far as I know. But you could still have additional people that are brought in through that interpretation. But the Nebraska Supreme Court looked at that language and said, well, you are a person, because Mr. Clemens was the one that brought this on. He moved from Colorado to Nebraska, got into a barroom brawl, and when they ran his background, they saw he was registered pursuant to his juvenile adjudication, although he was well into adulthood by the time he got into the barroom brawl. And they said, you are a person, you do have to register in Colorado. It's black letter law. We're textualist here. This is what it says. This is what they mean. If that's not what they mean, they can give us additional guidance by exempting juveniles for the out-of-state convictions.
Let me quote right straight from the Supreme Court what they ruled. It says, when interpreting a statute, effect must be given, if possible, to all the several parts of the statute, no sentence, clause, or word should be rejected as meaningless or superfluous.
Well, that's what I was saying. It's, if you look at black letter law, that's exactly what it says. My fear is now, what can you do about this? Because you need a legislative fix, and it's going to be difficult. If it were me there, I would be trying to find a compromise where I could get the people. Maybe yes, maybe we do register them so that we're consistent with what we do in other states, but we don't have to list them on the internet because federal law doesn't require that to be AWA compliant. So you could take the posture, yes, we won't give them a safe haven here in Nebraska, but yes, we will register them, but no, we will not humiliate them and ruin their lives. I mean, that would be perhaps a compromise position that you could do. Has that been given any consideration by the advocates there?
Not yet, but I have talked to the staff people of several of the senators, including the one who introduced the bill, that didn't go through. And one of the reasons it didn't go through, we have what's called a short session and a long session. And for the short session, the State Patrol came in and stated that they'd already removed 65 people from the registry, so it wasn't necessary to pass a law. So it died in judicial committee. But I've talked with the people, and I suspect the first thing they're going to do is try to introduce what they failed to carry through last year. And of course, we want to support that, but it would be an interesting compromise to say at least not put them on the public registry or the public internet.
And then I would go a step further. I would say if they're still a juvenile, then they will not have to register with the adult registry officials. They would be registering with their juvenile supervising authorities, whoever that is in the state of Nebraska. Here it'd be the Department of Children, Youth, and Families that supervise juvenile offenders. But you wouldn't want them mingling with the adults if they're 15 years old and they have to go register. I would try to push for that. But the from a legal standpoint, the Nebraska Supreme Court, their decision is well reasoned. If you're a textualist, from the federal side, the federal court, their position was very well reasoned. Judge Koff and the Eighth Circuit affirmed Judge Koff when he ruled originally that question that juveniles didn't have to register without a state adjudications. They had it right. If you believe, you should look at the intent and look beyond black letter. So both of them are very well reasoned opinions. I just happen to like the one that the federal courts came up with a lot better.
Well, of course, I enjoy anything that gives us a better position and less registry and less people on the registry. But sometimes we have to live with what comes down, and hopefully we'll be able to work the legislature. But of course, it's not just the legislature, it's the governor, and that's going to be the most interesting challenge.
Well, I am somewhat skilled in legislative affairs, and I'll be of any assistance that I can be to help try to find some language that can be agreeable to keep these people. Hopefully the damage will be minimal between now and the time the legislature convenes in January. Andy, did you have anything else on the Nebraska?
No, other than that the population of Nebraska is 2 and both of them listen to the podcast. I find that pretty amazing just on its own.
We'll have to work hard in getting the other 5,200 on the registry to listen in.
Well, Ken, if you have anything else you want to say, otherwise, we really appreciate. Did you have anything that we didn't cover?
No, but thank you.
Appreciate your time, Ken.
Come in with us and spend some time Saturday evening.
Well, thank you. Have a good day.
You too. Bye.
Thanks.
That was interesting. That was some good info, good insight. And now that interview is done talking about Nebraska, then we have a couple voicemail messages to listen to.
Hello, this is William again. I have a different question I would like for you guys to discuss on the next Registry Matters that comes out after you receive this. Of course, we know that the Supreme Court in the case of Packingham versus North Carolina invalidated laws that banish registered sex offenders from social media websites such as Facebook, Twitter, MySpace. However, here in Tennessee, those of us on lifetime supervision are being told that that ruling does not apply to us because we're still serving a portion of our sentence, which is the community supervision. But I have heard others say that Packingham is the law of the land, and that that the wording actually can cover all sex offenders. And I would like for you guys to weigh in on that. And I guess I would like to know, do even supervised sex offenders who have diminished rights still have a First Amendment right to social media? And if so, what would be the portions of the ruling that we could cite that would uphold our rights too? Because lifetime supervision can be lifetime. You have to be on it a minimum of 15 calendar years. But in Tennessee, the courts have no duty to release you. And if they shoot your petition for release down, you have to wait 3 more years to renew that petition. And I can see the courts repeatedly turning someone down every 3 years until they go to their grave. So when you have a right that is abridged indefinitely, does that not rise to a First Amendment liberty interest, even for supervised offenders, when there's no guaranteed end to the supervision? So I hope you guys can give that a discussion on an upcoming episode, and thank you for the good work you do.
All right. There was one thing first of all, nobody uses MySpace anymore. That's just dead.
I think they had somebody sign in 2017. Someone logged in 2017. Yes.
MySpace got creamed, just absolutely obliterated by Facebook. So what do you think? Do people that are on lifetime supervision, do they have any recourse in related to Packingham? Does Packingham, is that part of the Third Circuit? Or not, I'm sorry, not the Third Circuit. That was a SCOTUS decision. So that does carry weight down to Tennessee regardless, right?
Yes. And I love that. What's his name?
That's William.
William's given us good questions. There are many questions buried in that one, but those are all good.
And I've been asked this question by other people also. So I'm just going to throw out my layman's legal analysis. Facebook and Twitter and all of those, they are under no obligation to let anybody on there. They are under no obligation to serve anybody except for what would be constitutionally protected race, sex, and those already identified protected classes. Correct?
That would be my guess. But William is going deeper than that. He's going to the state statute, or not the state statute. He said parole. He didn't actually say it was
right.
The statute, but he said these are conditions to be imposed. So we've got a lot of things to unpack. Supervising authorities have broad discretion in imposing conditions, but they don't have unlimited discretion imposing conditions. They have to have some semblance to what there has to be some relationship to the underlying offense and the offender characteristics. They just can't be blanket that they impose. What would trouble me, and what I think would be more fertile for litigation, would be, yes, William Packingham is the law of the land. It applies to people who are on supervision, but we don't know how far it applies because that wasn't the matter before the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court was considering a person who wasn't on supervision, who had this restriction placed on them by the state of North Carolina. But by reading what we call the dicta, their jargon in there, they said they found these restrictions particularly troubling for people who had served their time, paid their debt to society. By reading the dicta, you can conclude that they didn't say that it's okay for people who are under supervision to have these blanket restrictions, which is what apparently they're doing in Tennessee for people who are on lifetime supervision. Tennessee has a problem if there's litigation. Packingham, if they are just imposing these willy-nilly restrictions on everybody that you can't access any social media without any tailoring, without any relationship to a person who may have had a minor victim, who may have used some facet of internet communications to reach that victim. If they're just doing that, Tennessee would, in my opinion, would be very vulnerable to a challenge in terms of they can't just do that. But the answer always is, can they do that? They can do it. until they're stopped doing it. And what stops them, Andy? They stop because of their own volition. They take the initiative to stop doing it because they realize internally that this is the wrong thing to do. Or a Tennessee state or federal court tells them you must stop doing this because someone who feels aggrieved by what they're doing files a complaint. And the court intervenes and says, stop doing that. And in some cases, they don't stop doing it anyway. Like with the case with Joe Arpaio, he continues to round up people and continues to do what's against the law. And he gets held in contempt of court. And the president pardons him after he's convicted. But generally, judges try to hold people accountable for following their orders when they're told not to do something. So I think that there's fertile grounds for development in Tennessee if this is a blanket restriction applying to everybody without any tailoring. And I wish William luck in finding the resources to do that. That's the thing we battle is lack of resources. We have umpteen good challenges that could be made, but we don't have the resources to undertake the challenges.
What you're then saying is that the supervising authorities in Tennessee are not as pure as the wind-driven snow, and that they're going to be above and beyond what they're required to do in restricting people?
That would be what I'm saying based on what William has communicated to us, that this is a blanket restriction that they're applying on people. Now, if they are tailoring it, if it's only being applied to certain type of offenses and certain offender characteristics, and they're allowing them room to maneuver around the internet, with exception of social media sites that subscribe minors, then you get into a little bit more of an iffy situation. Can they do that? Because it all depends on whether it's blanket and arbitrary or if it's narrowly tailored and refined. And it sounds like it's blanket and arbitrary on everybody. And that's where they'll run into trouble if there's a challenge.
And when you say like custom tailoring it, let's just make up a hypothetical that someone is trolling a playground looking for victims, so to speak. That didn't involve the internet. So why would you restrict them from the internet?
Well, I would, if I were trying to make the argument for that, I would say that they have a propensity to offend against minors. Therefore, we would need to sharply curtail their access to minor victims. The internet could become the equivalent of the playground. I would make that argument.
Right.
And I think that would gain some traction.
Right. Can you modify my example to make that work to some degree, just to give something of a concrete example on how, I mean, you could turn, the internet is just the Swiss Army knife of everything. If you want to do something wrong, you can utilize the internet to do everything wrong. If you want to do bank fraud, you could use the internet. If you want to do sexual offenses, you could use the internet. It's not, you know, I mean, it's just the Swiss Army knife of doing everything that you wanted to do.
Well, his question was primarily about social media. And mm-hmm. as I took it, he said MySpace, but so I was taking Facebook and things where minors are present. There again, it comes into the offense. If you've got a 25-year-old who had unconsensual sex with a 22-year-old,
right?
That it would be hard to imagine if they met at a bar, and they had when they went back and he said, she said it was okay, she said it wasn't okay, and he did a plea. It would be hard to imagine that you could easily justify and tailoring any type of restrictions on the social media with that type of offense pattern. Because if you just have a blanket restriction that everybody who's on the sex offender registry, who's on lifetime supervision, of course, I don't know what it takes to be on lifetime supervision. I'm kind of in the dark and what all offenses end up in that category in Tennessee. But it depends on the particularities of that individual's offense and what they did and what their background merits, but they're supposed to do an individualized analysis. The courts have said repeatedly, don't do blanket internet bans. And that's what the Supreme Court pronounced in their dicta that they were concerned about, that they gave North Carolina the green light to narrowly tailor some social media. They didn't say you could ever do social media restrictions on sex offenders. They said, don't do a blanket ban.
And that's what we covered last week on the Third Circuit thing from up in New Jersey, I guess is where the case was.
Yes, I thought it was Pennsylvania, but it was a case out of Pennsylvania, I do believe, but it's in the Third Circuit, and in fact, William, there's a case where the West Virginia Supreme Court just recently ruled that supervised offenders cannot be blanketly banned, and they relied on Packingham, which is the law of the land. They said if the narrower ban, which was the case in North Carolina, was unconstitutional, that a full blanket ban there in West Virginia would be unconstitutional. So it's a matter of when there's a challenge asserted, and if there are good facts underlying that challenge, I think that the Department of Supervision, whatever they call themselves in Tennessee, will have to roll back their restrictions. But they can do it until they're stopped.
And as a reminder, the West Virginia one was a guy did like 30 years. He gets out, his girlfriend has a computer and a cell phone. Probation didn't like that, so they locked him up because he was in the proximity of the devices. He'd never, you know, he allegedly never touched them. They didn't have any evidence that he touched them, but they violated him for being in proximity of it.
So, yeah, and I don't remember all the particularities. I remember talking about it. I even wrote about it in a letter a few issues back. But the Supreme Court decision is binding. But the courts in Tennessee are going to have to adopt it. Someone's going to have to bring an issue raising that those claims that we're being blanket banned from social media. And Packingham says you can't do that, and see what the court says.
Hmm. Do you want to promote the phone call here in a couple of days, and then we'll move on to the next voice of my message?
Oh, I would love to. I don't know how to promote it, though, because the National Association for Rational Sexual Offense Laws is going to be having a cop watch on Wednesday night starting at 5 o'clock
watch.
Eastern time. We're going to be monitoring law enforcement's behavior with a hotline that where people can call in and tell us if they're being restrained in any way from their normal daily activities, whether they're required to stay home, whether they're required to report to a probation office, or what the restrictions are. And we're looking for some egregious ones. The more egregious, the better, because we're hoping to attach ourselves to some low-hanging fruit and initiate some challenges regarding the right to express and the right to association. Dressing in costumes, handing out candy, all those are protected rights. So we're looking at cops who are, for example, sometimes they show up in multiple agencies, show up on Halloween doing their home verifications. And
oh, yes.
You've got the marshals and the local probation, yes. The local sheriffs, and they all show up in a team and they demand to see your home. Well, mm-hmm. Perhaps if you're under supervision and the PO's with them, that you should let them in. But if the sheriff's office shows up by themselves and they have the marshals, out in the parking lot, and then all of a sudden they swarm and say, "Well, let us see your house," and you're not under supervision. You're not required to allow those people. We're going to be dealing with things like that if someone gets barged in on. We want to know about it. Who did it? What agency? And perhaps we can start winning some money and turning back some of these lawsuits. So that's going to be Wednesday, 5 o'clock to 10 o'clock Eastern time. And what should we give out the phone number or tell people how to find it? Go to narsil.org event calendar. What's the best way to get people aware of it?
Oh, I think all of them. So we should, if they want to just dial in, right?
Yeah, they could do that. And they could go to narsil.org and click on the event calendar and see the event, and you can sign up and you'll get a reminder. Or you can just simply dial in, or there's ways to listen online on YouTube. On the Narsil channel. Don't we have a YouTube channel?
We do have a YouTube channel.
In any event, they can call in, even if they want to listen on their telephone, they can call in. That's 641-715-3660. And the access code is 957-605-pound. So one more time, 641-715-3660. Access code 957-605-pound, and we're going to be giving away some prizes for people who sit on the call and wait for the opportunity to win a $100 gift card or a Narsil conference registration for 2019 conference in Houston.
Wow, that's actually a pretty good deal there.
Yeah, that's a $100 value there. Yeah.
So that's pretty sharp. Yeah, that'll be great. Then let's listen to a voicemail message from Jeff. It is similar to the previous one, but he has his own little spin on it.
Hi, this is Jeff from Kentucky. And I know that Packingham determined that the government could no longer ban sex offenders from social media. But what I'm calling about is I also read somewhere on Twitter that there was a case where the Supreme Court was deciding whether or not companies like Facebook and Instagram are allowed to ban people from their services because of the town square thing they were talking about. Now, I personally could care less about Facebook. However, I do a lot of online gaming. And by definition, gaming websites are still considered to be social media. What I'm wondering is, do you think the government could pass a law banning people from gaming websites, even though they are considered social media, and social media is considered to be protected now? But anyway, you guys take care. I love the podcast. Love what you do. Look forward to it every week. And take care. Goodbye.
I just want to add one little comment in chatting with Jeff. He said he needs the podcast every week. Like, it would be something that he is required to have.
Really?
Yes. We had a long chat back and forth on this and other issues.
What would happen if he didn't have it before we were around? We've only been around a year.
Well, yeah, I know. What did you do beforehand? I guess you don't know what you need until you have it. You know, people didn't know they needed a smartphone until they came out. But so anyway. So in another conversation, completely unrelated, I was speaking with another friend of mine today, and he does not get involved in our fight because he is too scared of any sort of retribution while he's still on supervision. I think it's a valid argument. But what I think is the short-sightedness, which is what Jeff is alluding to, is there may not be a restriction going on now, but that doesn't mean tomorrow, next week, next year, they don't introduce one that now you have to go fight against. So my friend that doesn't get involved in our fight, he's okay to function, but that doesn't mean something in the future doesn't mean that he's off probation. And then they start rounding up sex offenders on Halloween.
That's so we'll get back to the question, but that's the unfortunate reality of what happens. People get in a comfort zone where they've adapted to what has been imposed on them. And they manage to figure out how to make life work somehow. Now, a lot of people don't figure out how to make life work. They end up under bridges and end up in very ugly situations and sometimes back in prison because we have debtor's prison for people who can't for that person who believes they shouldn't support the fight, you can totally support the fight anonymously. Every state advocacy group needs funding.
Right.
It takes money to get to the Capitol. It takes money to do everything we do to get out literature, letters, to have minimal amount of infrastructure to do the advocacy work, even assuming that no one's getting paid. And as far as I know, no one gets paid except for the attorneys, but none of the people that lead at the state or the national level is drawing any salary. For him to believe that there's nothing he can do and he should lay low is exactly what the problem is. With hundreds of thousands of people on the registry laying low, we lack the resources to do the work because it takes just basic resources to do a minimal amount of work. So when a piece of legislation gets introduced in his state capitol and there's no one that can afford to be there because they can't afford to take off work, they can't afford to drive to Atlanta or Birmingham or Montgomery, actually is the capital of Alabama, they can't afford to do that, then he'll be whining later, well, how did that get passed? Well, it got passed because there was no one there advocating against it, just like happened in North Carolina when they challenged their proximity premises restriction and the federal court declared it unconstitutional. They simply introduced a new piece of legislation that in some regards is worse than what the federal court struck down, and they're all over it again having to fight that with a new lawsuit because there was no one in Raleigh representing the sex offenders. And so it's short-sighted. I'm disappointed that he feels that way, but that's unfortunately there's too many tens of thousands that have that same attitude. But to the question about could the government do that? Yes, the government can always pass laws. The courts generally cannot prohibit legislative bodies from enacting laws. But my opinion would be that the law would be very vulnerable to a challenge if they were to pass it. But nothing would stop them from passing the law. There's no analysis that takes place where something after it's passed that it goes through a constitutional check before it can take effect. It's presumed constitutional. So if they were to pass a law, if there was nobody on our side there advocating saying you can't do this, the Supreme Court's already said in Packingham, you can't do what this law proposes to do. If that law were to make it to the legislature, get signed by the executive, it would become operational and be presumed valid, and it would have to be a challenge to stop it. So the answer is yes, they can do it.
And they can do it until they're stopped.
They can do it until they're stopped. So you can either choose to try to stop them while they're doing it, or you can stop them after they've done it. It's
generally, which one's easier?
It's, well, if you have the right resources, it's easier to stop them before they do it. But you can't take a person who's never done anything in the way of public policy advocacy and expect them to magically show up in their state capitol and get to know how all that stuff works and who the right connections are and how the process works and to be able to derail legislation. That is a big learning curve. And generally, you need to hire experts, lobbyists that actually know how to work these systems, because the average person is not going to have those skill sets.
So in short, it's easier for us to contribute money to some group or person that can handle these things and work on our behalf, where the expertise is.
That's my opinion, and that's how we derail everything in our state, because we have the expertise and the relationships to do that, and we derail all the bad. Now, unfortunately, we weren't around derailing things when they started passing this crap in the 90s.
We could use your car as an analogy. I mean, you have an engine that needs to be replaced. You could probably read a book and buy all the tools, or read a manual, whatever, and buy all the tools and stuff to replace your engine. You're probably like intellectually capable to do it, but you'll just pay someone a few hundred, whatever, thousand bucks to replace your engine.
That wouldn't be the best use of my time, but theoretically I could do that.
Right. But the same point is that you're going to, you know, you're delegating, you're outsourcing to someone that can do it more efficiently than you can, which is the same thing here. There's a mountain of expertise that's required to go manipulate the state capital.
Absolutely. And the larger the state, generally the more complex it is. If you live in one of these states like Nebraska or New Mexico or Wyoming, where the population is relatively small and people are more open, try going to Sacramento and doing what I do here. You would have a lot of more barriers, because California is such a large state. The large states are much more challenging.
Do you mean large in size or in population?
In population, where you have a lot more people to deal with. When you're dealing with California and these large states, oftentimes you're dealing with a year-round legislative body that has a lot of staff and trying to get through to people. Where in Nebraska, you can walk in, you can roam the halls. There's no security. You can roam the halls and walk in on senators' offices. And if they're not on the floor of the Senate, you can have a conversation with them personally. You can't do that in Sacramento. You can't do that in Lansing. You know, you can't do that in large states where there's a great number of people.
Interesting. And then we have one final question that is going to be about going to college.
Hi, I had a question. I was wondering, when it comes to employment and higher education, such as college, do you think that a registrant would need to also let their registry know that they're enrolled in an online course or an online job? What do you think, guys? Because I know that it applies to a physical workplace and a physical college, but I'm wondering, does it also, that law also apply to online work and online education? I was just curious, something I just thought of today.
That's kind of interesting to me, in that you would have proximity restrictions against working in a place or where you can live. But how does that, or if you go to a college that you have to tell them that you're a registrant, how does that factor into doing online colleges, or if you're going to work remotely online?
Well, I love that question. Before I try to answer it, I'll remind people that this podcast does not give legal advice. These are really two guys talking. Nothing we say should be construed as legal advice on this question. And sometimes, after having said that, there are questions where we don't know the answer to. This is one of those where we don't have any case law. Absent specificity in the statute, if the statute says if a person attends college or a trade school, we could do the Nebraska model and we could say, well, textually it says if they attend school. And since they're not attending, they're at home, they're not attending. I mean, I would argue if a prosecution should ever ensue, I mean, first of all, to make this a controversy, someone will have to be, there'll have to be some prosecutorial entity out there that wants to prosecute for this. But arguably, if you're not attending, clearly the intent of the law is, I think anyway, is to make sure that the administrators of institutions of higher learning know that the person mingling on the campus has a conviction and is required to register. And if you're not mixing and mingling on campus, arguably you would not fit within the zone of the law. But what happens if a registry official says, well, you know, we got information that you're enrolled in online courses at the University of Phoenix, for example. I think that's a big online university.
It is.
And you didn't report that to us. So therefore, we're going to go down and file, get a warrant, and we're going to rely on the statutory language that says that you have to report however it's worded. And it's going to vary from state to state, jurisdiction to jurisdiction. But depending on the wording, how it's worded, it may literally be worded sufficiently clear that, like the Nebraska Supreme Court, well, that's what it says.
Right.
We're not going to look at what the intent might have been. We're going to look at, by golly, it says that you need to report any attendance, and it doesn't differentiate between online attendance and in-person attendance. So, by golly, you're guilty. And so, for those who want textual interpretation, you know, this might be a good thing for you to think about.
And I mean, we could go back to, I don't think it was Orrin Hatch, but that's always the name that I remember, where he was talking about the internet being a whole series of tubes. You have a body of predominantly white men who are about 100 years old that know nothing about the internet, but they're legislating for the rules of the internet. And it's not, the technology is evolving significantly faster than they can ever attempt to adapt law to it. And this, you know, these statutes were probably put in place before anyone really even considered that online
Absolutely.
Colleges would be a thing.
Absolutely. When most registry statutes were written in the 90s, and they've been, of course, amended depending on which state. Some states are amended almost annually. But the framework, the basic framework, was developed in the 90s. The Jacob Wetterling Act passed in 94, and the states were given 3 years and encouraged to create registries. And that's 20 plus years ago, and nobody thought about online enrollment when they required that universities be listed.
It's Ted Stevens.
That would be the former senator from Alaska. Is that who you're talking about?
Yeah, that is correct. God, you know your people, man. So if they were written prior to the existence of the schools that would be that allow you to take the classes online, they didn't even conceive of it. I mean, I almost like a Second Amendment. When the framers wrote the Second Amendment, automatic weapons weren't a thing. They couldn't even have conceived of it. So when the legislator was writing this law for you have to tell your institution that you're on the registry, they couldn't even conceive that you would be sitting in your home in your underwear taking a class in a college that's 2,000 miles away. But doesn't he, like, why would you have to tell them anything?
Yeah, well, and then the other part of his question was related to employment, which that issue does come up periodically in a similar context of, for example, a self-employed person. And I go to my state, it says you have to notify your employer, and if you're volunteering or a person, or your supervisor or a person similarly situated. Well, if you're self-employed, you are your supervisor.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not the way law enforcement interprets it. I have had reports of people telling me that they make service calls, and before they can make a service call, that they have to notify the person that they're on the registry. And I said, well, that's the officer's opinion, but there's nothing underlying that opinion. There's nothing in the way of case law out there that I'm aware of, and I'm generally the go-to person here. I don't know of any case law that's interpreted that a self-employed person has to notify their customers that they're on the registry. But when they were writing this, since the sex offenders weren't part of the process, nobody other than law enforcement was writing these statutes back when they were first developed. They were given templates as an example by the federal government, and they used that as boilerplate language, and they followed it with some tweaks. And no one was thinking about, well, what about the person self-employed? Who would they notify?
Right.
I mean, most people that are self-employed probably have notified themselves.
They may know. They may be in the know that they are in the registry.
And they are the supervisor or the person similarly situated, in my opinion. But here again, what would a court say? Because this is a matter of first impression, since there's no case law in the state guiding that. What would a court say about that if the law enforcement was determined to make a prosecution and a person was determined to go to trial rather than copying a plea because you'd get probation as your first offer here if you've got no registry violations? If the person did a trial, what would the trier of fact decide, if be a judge or a jury? Of course, I'd want to try this to a judge, I think. I think a jury might not be too particularly sympathetic to it, but what would the outcome be at the trial court level? And then you've got an appeal ahead of you to figure out what that meant to notify your employer, supervisor, or person similarly situated.
That is pretty much crazy.
Well, let's just turn it over to the computer and ask the computer what it meant.
Yeah, I don't think the computer's had to deal with this yet.
Well, you've told me that we should put all judges out of business and let it decide by the computer. So what would the computer decide?
I don't have an answer to that question. It's a good point. Hang on. I got this clip working now. Here we all go. Right.
They deliver in other ways, but they want to deliver vast amounts of information over the internet. And again, the internet is not something that you just dump something on. It's not a big truck. It's a series of tubes. And if you don't understand, those tubes can be filled. And if they're filled, when you put your message in, it gets in line. It's going to be delayed by anyone that puts into that tube enormous amounts of material.
It's a series of tubes. It's not a big truck.
Well, I mean, that would be, with my limited knowledge, I mean, I would say something to that effect. Of course, I would not try to describe the internet because I'm woefully inadequate, but I would say something along that line, you know, that you get in line. I don't guess everybody can transmit things internet simultaneously without some kind of traffic management, could they?
You could liken it to like the old bank tubes that they would use to shuttle your deposits around, but it's not really quite the vast amount of stuff that it is. Is it's significantly larger capacity.
Well, I mean, but with a person of his generation, if he's still alive, he's got to be 90. And I think he may have passed away, but that was probably as good as I could describe it. A series of tubes.
Yeah, but you can't bottle up your college education into that series of tubes and ship that around like that. It's not the same thing.
So, yes, he's passed away in 2010. So it's been 8 years now.
I guess it's no longer a series of tubes.
Yeah. So he said that at some time in the past, but he's been deceased for 10 years.
Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact them by email, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can call or text a ransom message to 747-227-4477. Want to support Registry Matters on a monthly basis? Head to patreon.com/registrymatters. Not ready to become a patron? Give a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. Or tell your buddies at your treatment class about the podcast. We want to send out a big heartfelt support for those on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed. You make it possible.
Yeah, we need to move on to a Halloween extravaganza conversation. We got people being locked up. We have people being handed out signs. It's kind of like some craziness.
It's very, very crazy and disappointing to me, and I'm not impacted by it. But I can only imagine, I tried my best to imagine, if I were raising a family and I had little ones, and I was having to explain this to my little ones, think about it. If you look at what Halloween is to compared to what it was decades ago when we were young, it's really become quite an event.
It is definitely that.
Costumes and the amount of sales. I think it's in the top 5 days of retail seasons, Eastern, Christmas, but it's a huge amount goes into Halloween. And to think that even though there's absolutely not a shred of evidence that we have been able to unearth anywhere about a sexual offense being related to a registrant being committed on Halloween. Now, there's no doubt there are sexual offenses that are committed on Halloween because they happen 365 days a year. I don't think there's any day. But we can't find any evidence to justify this craziness of them spending vast amounts of resources to go out and monitor a non-existent problem and to scare people the way they do, where children can't go out and enjoy the holiday the way we would have done in our day because of imaginary boogeyman. And then they've taken it to the level of interfering with people making a living, forcing them to stay off their job. I can't believe how far we've gone to the point of ridiculousness. So it's a big issue for us to be talking about this. I'm glad we're talking about it.
Yeah, and you can find this article. You can find similar articles all over the place. The one that I latched onto was Reason. Reason seems to be reasonable on this particular subject most of the time. And there's a small town here in Georgia that the mayor, Grovetown, Gary Jones, announced on Facebook Monday morning there are approximately 25 to 30 offenders, and they will be overseen by four officers from Georgia Probation Department and one Grovetown officer. They're going to round them up into the council chambers on Halloween night from 6 to 9 p.m. And this a friend of mine in the Augusta area, which is sort of near Grovetown, I guess, he's got to do something similar and go hang out in probation. And you can't bring a phone. So, I mean, you just got to go sit with your thumb up your tush for 3 hours and not do it. Like, you shouldn't be hanging out with these, what's the word? Deplorables. That's a fair word. But now you're going to be corralled together with, you know, I don't know, 100, 200 of your closest friends that have all committed roughly similar offenses, but you can't associate with them, but we're going to put you in a room together and you don't have any other way to distract yourself for 3 or 4 hours.
Well, and what I would like to know about the Grovetown containment would be if the people are required to take off their work. Now, in my state, there are some parts of our state where they're requiring people to take off work. We've gotten reports from Suffolk County, New York, where they're required to take off work. This Grovetown is in Columbia County, which probably few listeners know the history, but Columbia County Sheriff back about 10 years ago, or a little more than 10 years ago, when Georgia decided it was going to crack down on sex offenders, they passed some very extensive proximity restrictions, and they added in school bus stops. And the
that's where that came from.
That was the Columbia County Sheriff, and he says, "I tell you one thing: I put my hand on that Bible, and I swore I was going to uphold the law of the state of Georgia. And we have a law that says that it's retroactive, and they can't be living near all these things. And by golly, I'm going to enforce the law." And he picked a fight with a lady named Wendy Whitaker. And the case was Whitaker versus Perdue, who was the governor, who's now the Secretary of Agriculture for the United States for President Trump. But that case actually ended up making things better for Georgia because there was a federal lawsuit by the Southern Center for Civil Rights out of Atlanta. And old Columbia County Sheriff, his name is escaping me, but he ended up looking like the bad guy because he picked a fight with a person who elicited a little bit of sympathy. Her offense pattern was such that people could identify with having sex in high school. I think it was a high school offense where she was a little older than the other high schooler. But he ended up picking a fight with a person who outdid him. And the federal court was about to strike Georgia's restrictions, so they decided to peel back on their own and not wait for Judge Cooper to do them in on that challenge. And there was a settlement after the legislature made changes and they took the retroactivity out and they narrowed those restrictions. But that's a county where they are notoriously hard-nosed, right-wing. By golly, I'm going to enforce the law, so I'm not surprised. I think this mayor actually had some publicity a few years ago. I forget about something else, but his name sounds familiar. So this is not the first time he's been in the news.
In the article, They cite from Lonor Skenazian, a thorough study of 67,000 cases of child molestation found zero increase in crimes against children on Halloween. Yet here we go, on one day out of 365, we're like, oh my God, these people are bad, because no cases have been found. I have a massive problem with lack of evidence behind policies. Or medical treatments. If there's no evidence to support what you're going after, I can't figure out why you would do it just because it makes you feel good. Get that crap out of your head of something that makes you feel good is the right way to go. There should be, I can't figure out, like Halloween would be the one night of the year that kids are like massively supervised. You don't see kids just running around on the streets without mom and dad or a mom and dad nearby.
Well, that's the point I was making. You don't now because of all this fear, but you used to in days gone by. I mean, we would never have thought of having an adult with us when we're old enough to, if you got a family where you got a 12-year-old and a 9-year-old, a 7-year-old, the 12-year-old supervised us when we went out and we went out trick-or-treating. I mean, I never would have thought about having mom and dad, right. So,
Even that, like safety and numbers, you don't see one kid by themselves. And I bet you there are ridiculously small numbers of groups of kids ever being abducted. It's always going to be a one-off, like you see in the horror movies where they get separated and there's one off by themselves and that one gets snatched.
Well, there's no evidence of that happening on Halloween.
I know that's, I'm like you, even in that case, but the kids are always going to be bunched up. And I don't understand why we do this and why we accept doing it. In reading the comments on this knucklehead's Facebook page, people are like, oh, these people are terrible. They should actually be killed. I was like, okay. I mean, I guess that is one solution to a problem. If all the registrants are killed, then you don't have to worry about recidivism.
Well, that would reduce the rate from 2 or 3% down to zero, but I don't advocate that as a policy.
No, we don't.
Well, I don't know about we. I'll say I don't support the death penalty. I can't speak for the other half of this podcast crew, but I don't support the death penalty. But you're right. There's the supervision would be horrendous on Halloween. The likelihood of anything happening, a lot of people that promote these policies are the same people who claim that government shouldn't do something unless there is a real problem that you're trying to fix. Well, okay, there is no problem on Halloween, and you're spending millions of dollars nationwide to divert your law enforcement resources to go on these phony roundups, and you're disrupting people's lives and their family and their livelihood when there's absolutely nothing behind it other than scare tactics.
It's really, really poopy, man. It's really, really poopy. I have a question for you, Larry.
Hopefully I'll have part of an answer.
Did you receive your no candy here sign from your sheriff?
I have not received that sign.
This article from KansasCity.com, sex offenders get no candy signs from Missouri sheriff just in time for Halloween. It's a pretty short article, not a whole lot going on. However, they do have an app, too, that you can then plan your route around where the registrants do live so that you can avoid their houses. But they're handing out signs. You can make your own if you'd like, but the sign says, no candy or treats at this residence. And it says that there's no, there's no suggestions on how the sign would be presented out. So, you know, put a piece of tape on the door or post it up on your, you know, in your window or something like that. They have to be inside the residence from 5 to 10:30 p.m. on Halloween night. All residential lighting has to be turned off. And sex offenders risk a Class A misdemeanor for breaking these laws.
And the article also says that this is out of Missouri. This is referencing Dent County, Missouri. But they also, if the article is accurate, that these prohibitions on candy were also in place in North Carolina, Ohio, Tennessee, and Texas.
In Georgia.
Well, but these are apparently laws where in Georgia it may be a supervision requirement, but these are apparently statutory schemes that bar people. And Tennessee, we've gotten a number of calls about from William about the extreme restrictions.
Yeah, the 21-day thing.
11 days.
11, sorry, whatever. Yeah.
but I'm hoping William can can hook up with some legal resources that would be interested in initiating, or at least examining and possibly initiating, some challenges in Tennessee, because they're not going to stop until they're stopped.
Tell me, let's recover the issue of, doesn't this fall into a compelled speech First Amendment issue?
Well, I'm not an expert on that, but it certainly looks like a compelling case can be made. I think that's not as strong of an argument as other things. I think the more compelling argument is the freedom of expression and association.
Okay.
Because you have a much stronger argument to say, I have the right to decorate my house as I see fit.
Right.
I have the right to associate with people in my neighborhood as I see fit. And you're prohibiting me from having an association or an expression.
And
the no candy sign is the weaker of the allegations, but you could certainly throw it in.
Does any of this count for someone under supervision?
Well, you have a diminished expectation of liberty while you're under supervision. I would imagine if you were in prison, you wouldn't be able to hand out candy. I'm guessing that they probably wouldn't. Do they do Halloween in prison?
Not Halloween, but they'll do other holidays. But no, it's not like they have Halloween costumes on the store.
If I were picking my challenges, I would not pick this as one to assert on behalf of supervised offenders. Although I don't think it's totally without merit, because there again, you do have some First Amendment rights. We would just have to drill a lot deeper and be a lot more creative in terms of. This is a very minimal amount of time, three and a half, four hours, where you're restricted in terms of your expressive rights. I would rather be making that argument on behalf of people who have paid their debt to society. I think that if we learned anything from Packingham, we've learned that people who've paid their debt have greater expectations than people who haven't.
I'm really intrigued by the expression one of decorating your house as you see fit. And where that line would get drawn. It's the fall season and people have pumpkins. My neighbors have two pumpkins sitting on their doorstep. Could I not have a pumpkin sitting on my doorstep?
Well, we don't know. You'll have to put one up and we'll find out.
Pumpkins are kind of notoriously like a fall thing, but they're also very much associated with Halloween.
Well, don't people eat pumpkin? I thought that was a food, isn't it?
You would definitely make like pumpkin pie and all kinds of other stuff with it. Yeah, certainly.
Okay, well, so I guess the question is, it is a carved pumpkin? Do you have decorations on the pumpkin, or is it just a whole pumpkin sitting there on the porch? Which are we talking about?
I was just going with a whole pumpkin, just the gourd sitting on my front doorstep. And I was going to start escalating it up, just like you described. Could I have a carved pumpkin inside, et cetera? But so I just have the big fat orange thing sitting on my doorstep.
Well, I would say that would be your strongest position to be in if you were going to try such an endeavor, to say it's merely food. I'm letting it ripe.
Now, if we start if I carve something that is not kid friendly, you know, some sort of, I don't know, demon looking thing that is not inviting, am I decorating to invite kids?
Well, we'll have to find out, but I would not want to fight that battle. I would try to find something that was a more substantive thing to fight with a probation supervision system than a 3.5 hour deprivation on Halloween. I'm not minimizing it, but I wouldn't pick that fight just to find out the answer to that.
And by golly, if you're not home, decorate the hell out of your house. You're not going to be there to answer the door anyway.
Oh, well,
decorate the shit out of your house with all kinds of gadgets, lights, and all that stuff, and let every kid in the neighborhood come knock on your door. You're at the sheriff's office.
Of course, in my state, in your supervision conditions, they tell you that you can't put up any decorations. That's in the Halloween little memo of understanding that you signed.
Uh-huh.
You're not allowed to do.
Yeah, but we have some level of interpretation that we would be looking at of what, like, you just have to have a naked front door. You know, the whole front facade of your house is going to be naked of all anything.
Well, I suppose so if you're under supervision.
Christmas wreath, you're putting it up early?
Well, therein lies the question. How far can they go with this? What about when we get into the religious holidays?
That's where I was just about to go.
It's not that, but what happens when we get into the more of the religious holidays that people decorate for? Are you going to interview?
Halloween is like Day of the Dead. I mean, this is, you could have a religion. You could assert a religious element to Halloween. there would be people that celebrate Halloween as a religious thing, I think. It's still, you could fabricate your own religion, even if there isn't one already out there, that you could say, hey, this is my day that I celebrate. And now seems like you would have a very strong First Amendment claim there.
Possibly. A lot of these things we don't know the answer to. We'll have to run them up as challenges and find out.
I'll tell you what, I'm going to be on that call and I'm going to put some Halloween stuff out there. And I say, FYP, bring it.
Well, I look forward to what happened. Do you have my phone number in your memory in case you find yourself in a correctional facility?
If I do call you from a correctional facility, you're just going to say something like, you're a dumbass, and you're going to hang up.
I would never do that. But now you realize supervision violations most often result in no bond holds.
I'm not doing that. I was really just jerking chains out there, man. Well, I don't have anything else. Do you?
I don't. I think that this Halloween hysteria has gone too far, and I really would hope that people would be a part of the marathon that we talked about. Call in, give us information, help us figure out how to make a stand, because it's for the good of everybody. If we don't push back, they will never run out of things to add to the list.
Right.
The list keeps growing.
Well, do you want to plug the NARSAW call again before we get out of here?
Sure. Wednesday night, Halloween, 5:00 Eastern time until 10:00 Eastern time, we will have a cop watch. It's called the Halloween Marathon, but we also subtitled it the Cop Watch. And we're going to be doing a press release on Monday, letting the media know that we're also watching the cops. And we want reports of anything that's restraining you by way of probationary, parole, or statutory schemes, and particularly home visits that are happening. If they're barging in on you and telling you things that you can't do or being rude and obnoxious, we're itching for a fight, and we're trying to find the right fight. So help us on the cop watch. Listen, call in 641-715-3660. That'll get you on the conference platform, and then access code 957-605-POUND. And we'll be taking calls all throughout that 5-hour period. You don't have to be there for the whole time. You can pop in, listen to various things we're talking about. We're going to be talking about cases and filling time when we don't have people calling us with particular questions about Halloween. And then we're going to open the lines continuously. That's going to be kind of problematic since we don't have a back channel like regular talk shows do to know when they have Halloween stuff to report. So we're going to be working on a way that they can communicate with us back channel, so we know that they want to go live with a Halloween report. But we're going to take as many calls as people will give us with information about Halloween restrictions, and hopefully we'll dig out something that's ripe for a challenge.
Outstanding. And then one other thing, if you want to do it on YouTube, you can just go to youtube.com/C/NARSAW. That'll get you there. I think if you just do a YouTube search for NARSAW, you can also find it. It works out pretty well to go that way too, if you're not terribly interested in calling in necessarily, but the quality there is pretty good. And then you can also chat. I'll be in there and chat.
I've heard that the sound quality is excellent on the YouTube channel. People say, wow, it's really good.
It is.
We need to grow the podcast, Andy. How do we do that?
Oh, hey, we need to grow the podcast. We tell all of your friends, your neighbors, anybody on the registry. We just heard about how many people on the registry in Nebraska. There's two people that listen to the podcast. There's two people on the population
and
in Nebraska
on the registry.
I couldn't figure out how that math worked, but okay. So why don't we have 5,000 people from Nebraska listening? All you people should be listening. The website is registrymatters.co. The phone number is 747-227-4477. It's a whole lot of fours and sevens. And you can email us at registrymatterscast@gmail.com. Of course, the best way to support the podcast is over at Patreon. That's patreon.com/registrymatters. And of course, find out about the Discord server if you want that link. You can find the show notes at the website, and you can get all those links there. With that, I don't have anything else.
Thanks, Andy.
Have a great night. Stay out of trouble.
Bye.
Bye.